Okay, so we had our story, didn't we, last night? I've heard that story a number of times, and what's so interesting about these stories, of course, particularly when they're told with such skill, is there's always more in them, isn't there? It doesn't matter how often you hear them, there's something new or something strikes you in a slightly different way or with slightly more force or depth or whatever, or you see a slightly different angle on it, resonates in a different way. And I find that very interesting because actually the way we tell our own stories in our heads when we meditate very often do not do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And I think this is a serious point. So these people, I've noticed this in the last couple of years, I'm not quite sure where, maybe I've mentioned this already. I first started noticing it when I went out and I was teaching in California, and everybody was saying to me, I've got to stop the story, I've got to stop the story. And I thought, well, good luck with that, one. And I also thought, why? Why can't you just listen to the story in a different way? If a story keeps coming, you're not listening to it properly, are you? It's still got something it wants you to hear. You know, if a story's coming from your unconscious, which I'm presuming it is, because actually, if it isn't coming from your unconscious, you've got something else going on. What you should be saying is, I've got to stop the fantasy. Stories, in this sense, like the story we had last night, and when we talk about myth, and when we talk about fairy stories, they come from the depth, they come from the unconscious, and we should listen to them, they've got something to say to us. This is different from a fantasy, which is the ego trying to manipulate something or other.
Is it the same as that Ali off? Is that?
I don't know. I don't know. No, that's collective unconscious. Oh, what is?
Yeah, like.
To be honest with you, I don't really want to get into discussion. But yeah, it's similar, I suppose. Okay. Collective unconscious. Yeah. But fantasy is when we all know what fantasy is. It's driven. It's sort of ego driven. Yeah. So you start off with, if I won the lottery, I would. Well, maybe I'll give them. How much money would I really need? Well, I'd like to give my mum $500,000, and then my sister, and it just goes on and on, doesn't it? You just get more and more sort of caught up, or whatever it is, or they said this to me, and blah, 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 blah. You know, and this is quite different. So that's a fantasy, that's not really a story. That's just maybe that's not a completely clean distinction. I think stories, sometimes start as stories, and then we don't quite like them, so we start fantasizing them. Anyway, whatever. So that's what happens. Anyway, I'm a bit thrown off. So we might have a session where we can have a bit of a dialogue, actually, but in these ones, I can't really do the dialogue a bit. When I was ordained, in El Convento in Italy, in 85, and I hope this is right, but anyway, I was sharing a room with a guy who became Vimlavadra. It was a very small room on the corner. It was quite cold towards the end of the retreat. It was a little monastery itself, because the place we were ordained was an old monastery. And it had become a glassworks after the Napoleonic invasion, but it was originally a monastery. And because both me and Vimlavadra came from a very political background, it was known as a communist cell. While we were there, one of us, I think it was me, found a copy of Italo Calvino's Italian Folk Tales, which is a fantastic book, actually. I highly recommend it. And every night, we used to take turns in reading a story to each other, a bedtime story. It was lovely. It was one of the enduring memories I've got. of the whole thing. And the interesting thing was the guy who owned that place, El Convino, was a friend of Italo Calvino. And I think this is true, though I couldn't honestly swear to it. So memory is a funny thing, isn't it? But I think Italo Calvino died while we were there in that place. And anyway, why I mention this is that it's not uncommon, again, I can't remember how much, but this motif of hands being cut off, usually children's hands being cut off, is not uncommon in folk tales. And I think it's quite an interesting motif if we don't take it too literally and start thinking, well, what is that about? Yeah. And sometimes, don't know, we haven't particularly done it this time, we spent a bit more time with the leg. Sometimes I will encourage people just to spend a meditation being aware of their hands. Yeah. Hands are very interesting parts of our body, aren't they? Metaphorically. I want to say this actually, the way I'm interested in the body mainly as a vessel of metaphor, a vessel of psyche, that the body, when we begin to take notice of our physical body, our hands, for instance, it leads us into psyche. Yeah? And hands in particular, of course, are the way very often, and it's interesting that we've got Mandava here, who's found herself, her calling in a way, towards being a storyteller. And she's also a puppet maker, and so she's someone that uses her hands. And hands are a sort of motif for the way we are in the world. Yeah, we're very often in the world through our hands. We make things, we cook, we wash clothes, we care for children, we make love, we manipulate things. Hands are this motif for how we're in the world. And of course they're also a metaphor, a motif for character. So this is why quite often your fortune, you know, we get palm reading, don't we? It's like your character and your fate and your destiny is somehow in your hands. We talk about things being in our hands, don't we? So this motif of hands is a very, very powerful. It's a very powerful image, the hand. So when we meditate and we pay attention to our hands, it takes us into a certain part of our psyche, a certain part of us. Yeah, and this is generally speaking how I want you to start to use the body. The body is an imaginal body in that it takes you into the imagination. Of course, sometimes we have physical pain, sometimes we're misaligned, so it has a physiological and energetic dimension. Of course. We want to get the postures as well aligned as possible, and this is important. But even more important is using the body as a imaginal tool, if you like, a way of igniting soul or imagination, or a way of being in the world, is ignited through paying attention to our body. So hands in particular, and in the story last night, of course, she, through no fault of her own, which is interesting, she loses her hands, doesn't she? And she's betrayed. One of the things that struck me very strongly last night, which had never particularly struck me before, was how negative the masculine is in that story. With the exception of the king, it's more or less entirely negative. The father really is quite pathetic. I mean, I'm not even sure that he isn't a double ganger for the devil, because he meets his own avarice in the woods, doesn't he, in a way? Okay, and his attempt to protect the child is pretty the mother's not much better, to be honest. Both parents are quite ineffectual. And the father betrays the child, really, doesn't he? Well, this is what struck me last night. Of course, it might strike you quite differently. And if it strikes you differently, that's as valid as it. You know, that's the thing about these stories. They're not some definitive explanation or meaning. They're fluid. So, but anyway, it struck me last night how negative, largely the masculine is. But anyway, it's not really. I'm not going to analyse. So I just wanted to talk about these silver hands a little bit. So they're very interesting. Okay. Because I think this happens to a lot of us. We're given silver hands. We're given silver hands. And she's given silver hands out of love, isn't she? The positive masculine in the story, the king, who falls in love with her, has these the most beautiful possible hands he can have made. He spares no expense, and he has these beautiful hands made for this poor girl who's lost her hand. So it's an act of great love, the giving of these hands. Okay? And these hands do really improve her life. They really improve her life. She's brought back into the world. So when her hands are cut off, she's basically lost, isn't she? She's lost in the negrito. She's lost in the darkness because she can no longer feel the world. She can no longer be in the world, manipulate the world, you know, be fully in the world. She can no longer be potent in the world. She's lost her potency. So this, you know, hands give us potency in the world, give us a way of interacting, manipulating and being in the world in a very tactile, in a very definite way. She's lost this. She's given these silver hands and it allows her to be in the world again. So in a sense, they're very positive. So what tends to happen to us as children, happens to a lot of us as children, we're given silver hands. And very often we're given the silver hands that the parent wants us to have. The parent wants us to have for very good reasons, because they love us. You know, they want us to be successful in a particular sort of way, and they give us a good, you know, if we're lucky. I mean, it is worth saying, just as an aside really, that the child is always to some degree betrayed. There's no way around that. Okay, I'll just leave that there, but the child is always to some degree, from the child's perspective, betrayed. I think that's probably true to say. But anyway, however good the parent is, and of course a lot of children are betrayed very badly by their parents. But anyway, good parents, most parents do their best, and most parents give us some kind of set of hands to be in the world with. But quite often these hands that we're given haven't got much to do with our own hands, as it were. Yeah, they are, however clever or beautiful or useful, they're not quite our own hands. So in this sense, as I was saying, the hands, we had the Buddha's, I think the Buddha's destiny was done by the stars, but it could have equally have been done by reading his palm. Yeah. So your own hands are kind of your destiny. Your calling, your thread to follow is somehow related to your hands. Yeah. And when you're given another set of hands, if you're really, really lucky, they fit like a glove. The hands you're given are just what you need. And they kind of fit like a glove, so all it does is give you a little bit more protection, or perhaps, yeah. Or, yeah. But sometimes you're given hands that don't really suit you at all. And they might be very successful hands. It might mean you go on and you become a chartered cowman or a doctor. You know, sometimes, you know, become something very, very noble, a doctor, or maybe you even become something artistic, you know. But actually, somewhere, it's not you. It's not quite you. And for a lot of people, and maybe this is just how it is, because for a lot of people, maybe it's nothing to do with it. It's no fault on anybody's part. So it's just simply, for a lot of us, we get diverted in some way or other from our calling, from who we really are, or that the culture, the society we're brought up in, we can't quite sustain it in that environment, you know. You know, actually, we just want to be living in the woods, you know, we just want to be that's that Badlands film, isn't there? That's such an interesting film, Badlands, if you've seen. You know, these two young people, they commit this horrendous series of murders, but then they're in this, they're living in wild in this thing, and it's sort of like they've gone back for a little bit, they've gone back to Eden. But in order to get there, they've had to do this anyway. It's an interesting movie, and another sort of fable, really. Anyway, so where am I going with it? I'm just saying that at some point, we have to find our own hands again. You know? If we're really, really lucky, we keep our hands. We've got our hands all the time, but that's quite rare, actually, I think. Partly because we just don't really know. We lose our calling, and that has to be rediscovered. So when we come to something like Buddhism, we've got to be quite careful, because Buddhism gives us a very beautiful pair of hands. Yeah? Gives us a very beautiful, very grand, you know, enlightenment, insight, all these sort of things. Gives us this very beautiful pair of hands. So when we start getting involved in something like Sri Ratna or anything, we've got to be very careful that actually we're not putting on another pair of silver hands. And that somewhere along the line we think, is this really me? Is this really, have I lost myself here? Is when I do my practice, when I meditate, and am I really following my own thread, or have I just taken on somebody else's idea? The Buddha himself was very keen on this, wasn't he? His last words, be a light unto yourself, or words to that effect, yeah? His last words, that's what's supposed to be, you know, strive on, be a light unto yourself. Right to the end, he was saying, hang on. You've got to know this by direct experience. Of course, to know something by direct experience, you've got to be quite mature, you know? You know, I keep thinking of that Leonard Cohen line, you know. I don't trust my inner feelings come and go, you know. It's like we can have this naive idea that we're in touch with our heart, and therefore if we feel something, that's what we should do. But actually this is very, very naive, you know. Because there's different levels in which we can be in touch with our heart, you know. Sometimes these people that are very in touch, think they're very in touch with their heart, they go through their life causing bloody chaos, actually, for other people, you know. Because there's these other virtues that Buddhism also emphasises, which is a sort of more dull, but that kind of consistency and patience and thinking, even things like duty, these old values that we don't need them anymore. But actually we do need them anymore, because we can't trust the heart until the heart is really properly plumbed in. The heart has got to be plumbed in, both to the mind, the intelligence, the rational faculty, and it's also got to be plumbed down into the guts and the bowels of you, because the heart isn't the guts of you, that's another instinctual, that's something deeper still. The heart's job is to mediate between what we can clumsily and not, you know, all these words, that they don't really do the job properly, but the heart's job in a way is to mediate between what we might call a head, the rationality, and the guts. Yeah? And also, the heart's job is to be open compassionately to the world. So there's stuff coming in through the heart, and then it's doing some kind of mediation between basic instinct and intelligence and wisdom. And this is how wisdom gets alchemically made in the heart. But it's not just, oh, I feel like this, so I should do that. You know, it's something a lot richer and deeper than that, you know, when we're talking, yeah? In a way, the heart is another motif, if you like. The true heart is another motif. It's pretty similar to having your real hands, you know? Having your real hands, knowing what you want to do. And for some of us, it takes most of our life to actually know what we're here for, know why we're here. This is a bit New Agey, isn't it? It's taken me, personally, a long time to be able to say things like that. It has, yeah? Since I don't come from that sort of background, and I find all this sort of New Age stuff very difficult. For a lot of my life, I'm very dismissive of it. And it's taken me a long time to start to understand that actually, in some way that I can't fully comprehend, I now believe we are here for something. You have got some reason you're here. And when you find that reason, you kind of know. You don't always know, because quite often we make all sorts of mistakes in our lives. We think we know, and then we find out, actually, no, that wasn't right. That wasn't. You know, I spent 30 years doing this, and actually now I think, no, I shouldn't have spent 30 years doing that. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough if that happens to you, you know. I spent 30 years in this job, or 10 years in this job, or I spent, you know, 10 years in this relationship, or whatever it is, and you think, and then suddenly you realise, no, this isn't me, I'm going against something. Fundamentally, I mean, actually, to be honest with you, the most important thing about what we're doing as Buddhists is to give us the courage to know, give us the wisdom and the courage, one, to know when we're going against ourselves, and the courage to actually do something about it when we know. And it's not easy. Most people don't, I'm afraid. I believe that. Most people don't do anything about it. They either can't quite recognise it, or they just don't have the courage, they just don't have the support, they just don't have the confidence, they just don't have, I don't know, they just can't quite do it. So for me, what we're doing when we're meditating, we're not trying to get to some superior place, we're not trying to be something we're not, we're trying to come into ourselves, come into our hands, come into what it is we're here for. It's already there. I mean, this is an important point. Of course, it's just one way of looking at it, and you can look at it from the other end, and it looks quite different. But one way of looking at it, and the way we've been looking at it, or I'm trying to give you the courage, is to think, actually, you've got everything you need already. It's all there, and you've just got to come into it. You just got to come into it fully. You've got to remember it, and you can remember it if you go back before. In a way, this is going to sound a bit bonkers, perhaps, but you've got to go back before the trauma. You've got to go back before the trauma. Of course, I don't mean this literally, I don't even quite know what I mean, but what I mean is that you came into this world with a calling. And maybe you had your hands chopped off. Pretty bloody traumatic, isn't it? In the story, she somehow, with the help of the white lady, actually, very interesting, isn't it? The white lady, she somehow gets back to before the trauma and finds herself, and of course this is symbolically reflected in the child, isn't it? She produces this beautiful child. Don't have to take the child literally. It doesn't mean we've all got to run out and have babies. It means we've got something to produce in this world. It might be a child, but it might be something completely different. We're here to produce something incredible and beautiful as a gift to the world. The funny thing about all of this, you see, I can talk like this, and you know, I enjoy doing so. And the funny thing is, though, when it comes down to actually your practice, it's so simple. It's so simple that people don't get it. I'm afraid most people don't get it. All we have to do is abide with our bodies in a particular way. Because actually, if we don't believe that, if we don't believe it's kind of there, and all we've got to do is sort of patiently abide and let it emerge, I don't quite know how the whole thing works. It doesn't work in this model. Of course, there is another model. There's a developmental model where we strive and we overcome and it's heroic. And that's a completely, I want to emphasize this, that's a completely valid model. That might be the model you have to follow at the moment. Yeah, it's there. The quest, the in the ashes, the kitchen work. We've got, all of us will have to do the kitchen work at some point, yeah. We have to be in the ashes at some point. But you've got to know, and it's very difficult, and I don't know how you know, you've got to know when you stop doing the heroic bit and you just start to abide. It may be even in any one particular sit, you get both. There's got to be some effort to start with until you get to a certain point. You've got to count on the breath. You've got to put some effort in until you get to a certain point, and then you've got to know when to drop it and just abide. Let things just emerge, and trust this process, which is, by its very definition, outside of your conscious mind. It's still your mind, it's still your psyche, but it's outside of your conscious mind. Or you could argue it's got to come into relationship with conscious. Anyway, we won't get too technical about the psychology of it, but yeah. And we've got this. She spent the maiden last night, she spent a long time in the dark wood, didn't she? Mm. This is, of course, Dante, isn't it? I found myself in a dark wood. She spent a lot of time in the dark wood. So maybe we have to spend quite a bit. We've got to be prepared to go into the dark wood as well. Yeah. You've got to know when. And actually, of course, the points, she gives up, but she prays, doesn't she? She opens herself up to forces that are beyond her rational mind. You know, this luminous beast appears. So this is the imagination. See, the luminous beast in this story is a motif for the imagination. And the imagination means we start to take the psyche, our psyche, the psyche, seriously. Which maybe at another time we'll see if we can go into this, because this distinction between this sort of material and fantasy, it's quite a difficult distinction, but it's quite an important distinction, because we're not talking about fantasizing about things, but it depends how we use this word. We're not talking about, just an ego fantasy about, if you start fantasizing about how you should be a rock star or whatever, maybe some of you could, I don't know. Probably missed your chance, most of you. Anyway, who knows? We digress.